All right, we're going to get started here. So if you can bring conversations to close or bring them out into the hallway, that would be great. Let's start with an online question. Does the sheep and goat judgment occur after the bowl judgments? And who is judged in each judgment?
Yes. Go ahead.
I would say yes.
What do you mean, I would say yes? It does.
I'm getting into it. Yeah. Yes.
No, the reason I can do that, I've read his writings on it. I mean, you know it clearly.
I feel like there's a trick
question. Okay. Like, oh, you thought it was a trick question.
I'm sure I don't answer the wrong question. Yeah, I mean, so Jesus has returned. He's executed the bowl judgments. He's liberated Jerusalem. So I would put the judgment after that, this particular, the Matthew 25, 31 to 46.
I'm not sure what he means by who is judged in each judgment.
The sheep are the unsaved survivors, Gentiles, that respond to the Lord, and the goats are the ones that don't respond to the Lord, and the brethren are the unsaved Jewish survivors that get saved.
Right.
Okay. Anita.
And the bowl judgments are specifically aimed at the Antichrist empire.
Just before Anita speaks, I just want to talk to our online people. And you know, we've got a new browser right now that we're using, a new video feed, and we apologize for the problems that you've been having tonight. It's running through a different online server, and that server is also having problems tonight. So
but we're improving the whole technology. We're just in
between. So we're working the kinks out, but we just apologize for the difficulties you've had tonight.
It's going to be better in a minute, though.
Yes.
Okay, this is a question from last week, Matthew 24. Matthew 24:10 says, at that time many will fall away and will betray one another and hate one another. So my question is, does this refer to the same event as 2 Thessalonians 2:3 and 1 Timothy 4:1? Is this believers or is this nominal believers who were never believers?
It's both and. I think it's both and, in my opinion.
So it doesn't matter which it is. The reason is because I've had people say that this is the sorting out of people people here in the community that this is the sorting out of people who never really were believers. And my feeling was, you can't fall away from something you never were in.
Well, there's two positions. I'll just be so brief on it. And I've held both of them, so I understand them quite well. That once saved, always saved. And if you fall away, because you never were saved, you were just a professor of, you professed Christianity, but it wasn't real. The other group says you really were saved and fell away. So whichever one it is, they fell away. And so,
okay. So
I tell the
both.
People, I don't want to scroll down and do Hebrews 6 and all the verses. I just say it's either one, but they fall away and they profess Jesus.
Okay, thank you.
I make it simple because you'll never convince one group or the other of the other one.
Another online question. Assuming that the parable of the talents exhorts us to use our innate talents for kingdom purposes, what is putting the money into the bank a metaphor for in verse 27, as opposed to investing it or burying it? Do you see the parable of the talents as having a literal financial meaning beyond just a spiritual one, i.e. to invest the money for God's purposes?
I don't. I think the principle of investing money's there, and I guess you could squeeze it into there, but I think he's really saying the guy buried it, and the Lord says, you should have done something minimal to multiply it a little bit. Even a minimal effort of walking a half a mile, dropping it in, as minimal as that in, I got a little bit of multiplication. You didn't even bother with that. That's the point he's making. And I think you could probably apply it economically, but I don't think that's the main point that's on Jesus' mind.
No, I think there's two main points. One is which is what Mike did so well tonight, is the smallest thing invested touches the heart of the Lord. In other words, he's not going to hold you accountable to something you weren't given. Whatever he gives you, because he says, enter into my joy, to the guy that has the most and the guy that has the other one. And I think the other's point for us to take away is the Lord seems to be hinting that people who perceive they only have a little are key to the end time story. And it's your perception you only have a little that can get you into big trouble when those dynamics begin to unfold.
I think there's one more takeaway as well, and it's to see how those three men viewed their master. And two of them felt that they didn't feel like the third guy felt. The third guy felt like, oh, you take from people what you didn't even do. You are a mean and nasty person. And apparently persons one and two didn't feel that way. They felt that they would be amply rewarded, that they would receive something in return. And so I think the takeaway for us is that our relationship with the Lord and how we perceive him is very significant to how well we will invest in his kingdom.
I have a question on verse 5 and 6. So actually two questions. So if the 10 virgins are, they're all asleep, and in Mike's note it says we interpret it in natural sense, then the first question is, what about the foreigners? Are they like those who cry in the middle of the night? Are they not sleeping in natural sense? And the second question is, do we identify ourselves and do we equip wise virgins or foreigners who are crying in the middle of the night, or both?
I think one of the main points of the falling asleep is it's going to take longer than you think. In other words, they all fell asleep because he was delayed, but some were wise and prepared, and I think that's the application. We want to be among the wise and prepared that have oil, even if it takes longer than you think. Does that make sense? Does that answer the question?
What about those who are crying?
I think they're identified with as the wise virgins.
Yep. Yeah, the forerunners are the wise ones that they're also proclaiming.
Right.
Mike, I had a question on the end of Matthew 25, the sheep and the goats parable. Fascinating teaching that it could apply to after Jesus returns and the Jews returning to the land. Does it also have application, though, to the church in the end times, in particular churches that may go apostate, that because they don't care about Israel, but they think they're honoring Jesus? I mean, are we to read it, like this could have multiple fulfillments, or is it, because I'd never heard the thing you said today, but I've always viewed it in terms of like warning the church in the end
because times. The Lord never changes in his values, though the church that's truly born again has been raptured. But we know before we're raptured with the resurrected body, those are the values he's going to evaluate our life on. He doesn't ever change. So we don't have to be there on that day. We could be in the New Jerusalem, but we know that when we stand before him, that's part of the criteria.
But I mean, is this part of calling the church like right now today?
Yes.
Toward, in other words, would it be a problem for churches to think they're going to make it through the end times and like, oh yeah, we love Jesus, but we're not going to care for the Jews, we're not going to put, do the things that, is it okay to warn people from this today?
Yes, yes.
Okay, as well as the message that you brought today about.
I think it's important to, a lot of them won't appreciate it, but it's important anyway.
Okay. I think that's why Paul was collecting money for Israel, is actually response. He knew that he wanted to sow seeds towards that judgment. So yeah, we respond now, even though it's a point in the future.
So it's clearly a both and. It both applies today and in Africa. Okay, thank you.
Online question. Do you believe the parable of the fig tree relates to Israel in 1948?
Yes, in some way, probably, but I don't know that we can specifically nail it down to 1948. But clearly Israel's a sign, and clearly the fig tree is meant to correlate to Israel.
Anything?
I was just a little confused if I heard you correctly towards the end when you were talking about standing with the Jews.
I was talking pretty fast at the end.
Yeah, it was good. Cramming it in.
A little bit fast.
Did you say that we were standing?
Benji, I want you to get everything. I want you to preach all this, Benji. You got it? Preach it better and slower and clearer and in English. Go ahead.
Were you saying that we're standing like those last 3.5 years with Jewish people who have taken the mark too? Who have taken the mark of the beast, the Jewish people, the last 3.5 years that have taken the mark of the beast.
I'm not understanding the question. Am I saying, did they take the mark?
No, are we standing with?
Or are we standing?
Are we
no,
helping
they
them.
Take the mark of the beast.
Yeah.
That's a different story.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the unsaved Jews who, I don't know how many will take it. Because I know the Hitler regime, not that you can't make it exactly the same. They didn't want Jews in their army or military or their service.
Yeah.
They found out they were Jews. They go, no, you're not welcome. But I don't know. Maybe the Antichrist is so proud. It goes, yeah, as long as you worship me, sure, come on in. I don't know. I can't tell.
Okay, but not. standing.
If they take the mark of the beast, that's a different story. Yeah.
Right, yeah, okay. Just checking.
There's going to be millions of them that need help. And the Corrie ten Boom story is the story. You know, how they took them in, and it's going to be intense.
So I just had a question about Matthew 25, 31 to 33, whenever it says, when the Son of Man comes in glory and all the holy angels with him, then he'll sit on the throne of his glory. And it sounds like he's separating, like he's doing like a final judgment, as if he's sitting on his throne and that he's sitting down and that he's making a final judgment. Is that more temporary at the very beginning of the millennium, or is that like a big argument for all millennialism?
No, I mean, I would argue it's the beginning of the millennium, that those two verses are meant to drive you to Daniel 7, because what he's saying is, I'm going to sit on the throne of glory that the Ancient of Days had established. He's making a massive claim that he's got all the authority of the Ancient of Days, and since that other language is saying, I'm the one executing that judgment in that passage is timed to the end of the rule of the beast. So I think that's why we would put it at the beginning of the millennium.
Yes.
Online question.
Myra, you throw in an answer too, if you want. I just said we'll just limit it to the first two that answers, but throw some in
so
there.
So I can answer questions, I just can't ask them.
Ooh. Okay.
Yeah, I think that works really well, actually. I'm in favor of that.
Online question. Thanks. On page 3, paragraph E, you connect the buying of oil to acquiring intimacy with God. In your teaching on Zechariah 4, you seem to connect the oil dripping from the olive tree into the lampstand in a similar way. Considering the many other references to oil, like Psalm 133, do you apply this imagery there as well, or only in certain places?
Only in certain places.
Okay.
Because oil can mean 5 or 10 things. In Matthew 25, it is the oil of intimacy. And the Zechariah 4, it's more than intimacy, it's power. It's the two witnesses' power. It has intimacy too, but the oil of unity, I mean, there's got to be some intimacy in there. Yeah, there has to be, right?
Yeah.
How are we going to walk together if we're not walking with him?
That's a good point.
So yeah, I guess we're kind of squeezing it in there, oil everywhere. Maybe I take my answer back.
Yeah, I think you talked yourself into a different answer.
Yeah, I think I just changed my position.
My question is from last week, Matthew 24. You broke up the 22 signs of the times into the 12, like pre kind of birth pangs, the 5 that increase after, and then the 5 that are happening during the 3.5 years.
Very good.
It's just your notes.
Yeah, but you said it.
But you put the gospel being preached in all nations in that category, and I've always thought of that as like happening now, you know, like.
It so, is. So that was wrong for me to do that.
Putting it there?
Not sinful wrong, but academically wrong. She looked at it, tears her, she goes, oh, I'm sorry. She was starting to pastor me here in a second. No, I mean, I should have. The gospel being preached, it really is through that whole period. And so someone asked me in a meeting earlier, why did I put it there? I go, yeah, that was not the best.
Okay. And then, so it's happening like, all before.
It's even happening right now, actually. Okay. The greatest harvest, Kathy, talk about it. The greatest, you've done the mission works over the years, and the greatest harvest in history is happening right now. So it's not going
it's
to begin there.
It's astounding what's going on all over the globe, in the Buddhist world, in the Muslim world, in the Hindu world.
Hundreds of millions are getting saved.
Yeah.
And one other question on that. So in that same the 5 signs, it talks about the Sabbath being restored in light of Jesus saying, pray that it doesn't happen, that the abomination of desolation doesn't happen during winter, the Sabbath. So Israel, they're still celebrating the Sabbath a little bit over there. Why is that like considered a sign of the time?
Well, I mean, the quick reason would be like, for example, right now in Jerusalem, your transportation is shut down. Your public transportation systems.
But why is that a sign of the time?
But why is it a sign of, like, because it's in, like, one of the 5.
Because for 2,000 years, there was no Sabbath in Israel.
That's a relatively new development that the government enforces a shutdown in Jerusalem of certain key systems. That hasn't been that way for thousands of years.
And it's happening now.
Yes.
Yeah. not the whole land, but Jerusalem, the key infrastructure does shut down. Oh, yeah, the ultra-Orthodox would have a riot if they started running.
But it's legal. It's part of the legal system. Yeah. It's official. So if you had gone to someone 100 years ago and say, hey, is there a Sabbath in Jerusalem? They're going, no, that's not impossible. Until the Jews control Jerusalem, that's never going to happen. There's never going to be a Sabbath there, so that's truly a sign of the times.
That's happening now.
In Jerusalem, yeah, the whole nation, no, that may be the confusion. Okay. Israel doesn't shut down the Sabbath, but Jerusalem does in a specific
way. So up in Galilee area, it's not a law?
No. The system's... I'm not sure.
Up north, too, and...
Yeah.
I'm going with Anita.
No, I mean, he is right. It's,
that's good.
It depends on if there's religious communities there, I think is my point. But,
so should that also...
I don't know.
So is that one also considered then in that 3.5 years, like there for sure, it's like the Sabbath is happening?
Yes.
Okay.
So if they get the temple built... The Sabbath will be super important. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're not going back on any of that. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I think it's odd that they can pray, and the abomination of desolation would be shifted a day, because the evil people they know that verse. They go, we're not shifting it. You wait and see. We're putting it in winter on a Sabbath. There you go, and we're going to pray, and it's going to frustrate them and shift.
So when you were talking about, this is a comment and then I have a question. When you were talking about, he says, I do not know you, but you're saying it's not.
I might be wrong on that.
Right. But I was just thinking, that sounds like 1 Corinthians 3 when he says these guys are saved through fire. Yeah, their work is burned up, but it's the day of the Lord that actually reveals it. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Sounds good.
And so my question is about eternal judgment. The body of Christ throughout history has had a long history of anti-Semitism. Do you think that is a criteria by which the Lord sends people to hell? And then going with that at the Great White Throne Judgment, these guys don't die. He just sits on a throne and throws them right into hell before they die? Because at death comes judgment. So I'm wondering, like, anyway, that's my question about the
judgment. You mean the Matthew 25, verse 46, when he says, whatever verse it is, depart from me, go to the lake fire.
Yeah.
You're saying, does he throw them in that minute?
Right. Do they die? And then that's just he sits in Jerusalem and he gathers them. They're still alive. And then he throws them in alive.
Well, he's got all the angels working, you know. All right, the angels are part of this.
I'm just saying they don't die, though, and then comes judgment.
I think to answer it
quickly,
one...
The angel puts the sword in him, and boom, he's gone. Depart from me.
I'm trying to honor you with this statement. There's only a few people on the earth that would ask that question.
I really care.
But I think it really comes down to that,
that is
in
an
many
interesting
ways,
question.
But in many ways, you kind of have to speculate to answer it.
Right. Okay. What a...
I think your other question, I would just say real quickly, I think that's warning us, like Mike said, this is going to become a litmus test at a specific hour in human history. I don't think that means everyone who's had arrogance towards Israel goes to hell in every generation, though that is a very dangerous thing. Paul warned about arrogance, but I think that's a moment.
I mean, the oddest one is Martin Luther, who was used to bring justification by faith to the earth, but had anti-Semitism.
Right.
I don't even want to know what the answer is to that. I just want to find it on the other end. Like, what? I mean, this guy's one of the most devout, prayed hours a day. I mean, was almost, you know, I was going to say beat, tortured, that's exaggerated, but in great trouble for many years in the Reformation, persecution, because he loved Jesus, but he was anti-Semitic. Like, what? I don't even get it.
So back to the sheep and goats parable, this may be redundant, but maybe for clarification, in verse 34, where he's speaking to the sheep, he says, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. And so this whole parable is about how they treated
that
the Jews.
That isn't a parable, just so you know.
I'm sorry, parable is the wrong word, but the story of this, but it's based on their works that the... So they're unsaved at this point, right?
We don't know about that they're unsaved at this point. This could be 3, 4, 8, 12, 18 months into the second coming. We don't know it's the first day. Nobody knows what day or how many days he does it.
So they could have gotten saved after the rapture.
Because there might be hundreds of millions of people. Do they all stand in one line? How many days does that take? I mean, we don't know that kind of stuff.
I think the short answer is we'd have to speculate on the specifics, but it's pretty likely if you're willing to stand against the Antichrist to preserve the Jew, that if a man descends from heaven and starts shattering the Antichrist empire, you probably turn to him
really
in
quickly.
A profound way. That would be my answer, but it's speculative.
Right, so it's an assumption because it says he's blessed of the Father. So, I mean, unless they were saved, I wouldn't think they would inherit the kingdom.
Right.
Clearly so, saved. I don't think if they were not saved, they would not have helped the Jews in flight. I think they are newly saved, and they're saying, whatever. He says, bring them back. He goes, okay, you're my captain. You're my Lord. I'll do it. How do I bring them back?
And is the kingdom referring to the millennial earthly kingdom then?
Yes.
Not, okay.
Yes, for sure.
And then one more quick question. Then verse 30, cast the unprofitable servant into outer darkness. This is the story right before then. Is that eternal damnation?
Yes.
It is,
yes,
for sure. So yes. whenever it says weeping and gnashing of teeth, can
always assume 100%.
That?
No, not 100%. I think weeping and gnashing of teeth lends to that because it's almost always mentioned in context of hell, but not every time. If somebody had the most horrible tragedy or the most shameful thing in their life ever happened and the whole world knew, they might weep and gnash their teeth but not go to hell. So that's a very painful, shameful thing. But not always 100% mean hell.
Okay, thanks.
Online question. Given that there are several thens in Matthew 24 indicating a chronological order, could the gospel of the kingdom going to all nations, which is in the latter part of that discourse, could that be the two witnesses or the angel in Revelation declaring the testimony of Jesus?
Certainly they're involved, but I think it's way bigger than that.
Yeah. Right. That's part of it, for sure.
Yeah, those guys, they do good.
Yeah.
We had a really fascinating discussion in our small group, and someone's mentioned that the abomination of desolation could happen in Passover time because, three and a half years, if you go 3.5 years from Passover, it will be the fall feast, okay, in which Jesus will return. And so, and then someone said that, the Antichrist will have a wound in his head, mortal wound, but then will be risen again. And so he may actually mirror what Jesus did during the spring.
I believe that's true, that he will mirror Jesus in that regard, yeah.
Yeah. And
but so, I don't know about Passover. Probably, maybe. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, it makes sense. I don't know if we can be sure.
But like Jesus.
We know it's a picture.
Yeah. Jesus came. First coming kind of was about the spring feast, but his second coming is about the fall feast.
That's true.
So,
no, makes sense.
Makes sense. Okay.
Good. We're not. Some of the stuff we're all fuzzy on, aren't we?
We're all learning.
Some of it, it's just not really spelled out exactly in the Bible, and so you can't be very clear. Exactly.
So my question is a little similar with another guy. Jesus said, if I'm thirsty and I'm hungry,
right.
Blah, blah. Yeah. So some people, they got offended by the Jews, but they do not take the mark of the beast. Right. So they do not help the Jews
right.
to go back to the Jerusalem, but they didn't stop them.
Right.
So do they really need to go to the hell? I mean, the Bible says, they will have everlasting punishment.
I think the short answer would be the intensity of the situation is far beyond anything we can imagine.
That's the
That's not an over. It sounds like an overstatement, but it's not. It's World War II does not even match the intensity.
Absolutely.
So I think it's the intensity is going to make that a litmus test that right now I don't think we can imagine, just to be honest.
Okay.
We can try, but we can't completely imagine.
Okay, another question is, Matthew 24, the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations. and then the end will come. So how to define the gospel to be preached in all of the world? Does that mean that all of the translated Bible or every single person hear the gospel?
You know, we keep getting that question from people over and over. And okay, my answer would be that God knows when it's done. And we can't really set a definition. There's you know, a sociological definition, there's a missiological definition, there's a will we guess, there's a, is it when people just, everyone has had it proclaimed to them, or is it when everyone has actually had somebody talk to them and specifically ask them that they want to be a Christian? I mean, there's so many variables. And so the fact is, until Jesus comes back, we have a job to do. Yep. We need to evangelize.
Yeah, so I want biblical answers to my question.
And we want biblical questions.
Don't ask anything that involves speculation.
So Matthew 24.
You don't want this speculation, eh?
Yeah. Matthew 24, verse 3. It says that the disciples came to him and asked him, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your kingdom and of the end of the age?" So I understand from your teaching last week that disciples probably were aware of Zechariah 14. So when Jesus mentioned verse 2, the destruction of Jerusalem, that they connected that to his coming, and there would be deliverance, right? But my question is that how did they connect the Jesus statement about the destruction of Jerusalem to his second coming, because he's coming, he was already there with them, so he has to be second coming, and the end of age. So how did they know that the destruction of Jerusalem is related to his second coming, when in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 1, verse 6, the disciples were still looking for the kingdom when he was on the earth, right, before the ascension? So how did they make that question and make that connection to destruction of Jerusalem that you just mentioned, verse 2.
I think...
Wait, keep it biblical.
I know. I'm going to try to quote Bible verses. I think, first of all, the whole thing's in context to the narrative that started in Matthew 21. He enters the city as king. So there's three questions. When is the trouble in Jerusalem? Which, like Mike pointed out, is a Zechariah 14. And so they understand that has to happen. What's the sign of your coming? The question is coming as king. If you're, because he just entered, as Zechariah said, the king would, but he's not being the king. So they're like, what is it going to take for you to be king? Which is answered in Matthew 24, verse 30. I'm actually going to descend with the clouds. And then what's the sign of the end of the age is what's the end of the pagan Gentile rule? Well, it's going to happen when I descend with the clouds, come as the king. And then it's going to happen according to Matthew 25, verse 31, when I sit in judgment and in the rule of the beasts. So I think their confusion is, if fulfilling Zechariah's prophecy, riding into the city, wasn't it, what does it take? And then Jesus gives them, here's what it takes. I'm actually going to descend from the heavens as a divine human, subdue in the age, etc.
Very good. Okay.
All right. I think we're done.
Oh. I have one more.
Come on, Abby.
I forgot about this question. So when I was reading the commentary notes that were in the packet or online, the author was saying how like the sun, the moon, like all of the shaking happening, that was like symbolic. But I've thought about it as like literal.
No, it's not symbolic.
Okay, because
not everything that we give you in the commentaries is to be believed.
Yeah, I mean, I was
they
like,
say it's symbolic because they're amillennial, and if they're amillennial, they're saying this whole end time scenario is not even real. It's poetic, right. Symbolic. So all
they were
stuff
saying
is
it
symbolic.
Had to do with like a ruler and like
right, that, because the commentary that you read this week and last week, both of them are amillennialists.
Okay? What commentary?
One was Leon Morris, and the other one was R.G. France. And so just like we don't completely agree with everything Constable says because he's a dispensational pre-trib guy, we don't necessarily agree with everything that these other guys say either. But we need somebody to write commentary from a post-trib.
What if that would be?
Where'd he go?
The millennial.
Thank you, guys.
Where'd perspective.
She gets all to right. push me around. We've been working together over 30 years, so she can do that.
All right, that's it. Thanks, guys.
Good. Thank you. Thank you.